Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Events over the past year have shone a light on racial inequality across the globe. Australia is no exception. This nation's journey towards a more just, equitable and reconciled identity still has a long way to go. With that in mind, and in a spirit of reconciliation, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community. We pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people today.
I ask the Prime Minister, how good is Australia?
Please explain.
Life is changing in Australia
because the pub is shut.
Sucked in, fellas.
I actually find it gobsmacking.
I will call it a personal nightmare.
Tell the Prime Minister to go and get...
It is changing all around the world.
I accept your nomination.
The authority is total.
And I rejected that approach.
It's all about acknowledging how far we've come.
He's all tip and no iceberg.
Like a really scary wooden puppet.
He was drunk.
That's not true.
Not now, not ever.
You're a classic space invader.
A social climbing sycophant. You should be ashamed of yourselves.
Oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
Taste of democracy, very good.
Hi there, Mark Kenny here with Democracy Sausage, which of course extrudes from the ANU's Australian Studies Institute in partnership with the School of Politics and International Relations and the Crawford School of Public Policy. Well, 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 Donald Trump was right about one thing at least. Big tech is bigger than mere government. Or rather, it's a very useful tool for populists like Trump until such time as they're banned or deplatformed. All he did really was try to overturn an election and incite a siege on the Congress when that didn't work, so I guess he has reason to feel aggrieved. But that brings us to Facebook. Speaking of being aggrieved, it's one of the world's most successful and most duplicitous companies. First it commandeered the word friend for its enormous commercial gain, and then it showed how little that term meant when it comes to its Australian users. The Facebook ambush on Australian users has meant news pages could not be shared nor their content loaded on Facebook. The implications of this have been far-reaching. Only this morning I heard a radio report of the news blackout this has imposed on Pacific Islander communities in places such as New Zealand and Australia, who rely heavily on the platform for local news from their homelands, news they'd have really no other way of getting hold of. Really quite disgraceful. And of course, we know that a number of emergency services and community bulletin pages were also caught up in the initial Facebook ban. Some of that's been restored, but many things that have been designated news remain. Those websites remain black. All this because this clammy behemoth doesn't want to share the advertising revenue this news content attracts. The case raises myriad questions about data giants, journalism, fake news, and the nation state. Joining me this week are two deep thinkers, Professor Paul Pickering, historian and director of the Australian Studies Institute, which actually makes him my boss, by the way. Welcome back, Paul.
Great to be here.
And Professor Shirley Leach, professorial fellow with the Australian Studies Institute. Shirley, great to have you back again as well, albeit from a slightly traumatised Melbourne.
Thanks, Mark. It's great to be out of lockdown.
Yes, it's. I dare say it's been a fairly triggering event for some people. That was the impression I got from people, talking to people in Melbourne, was that there was quite a different kind of, I don't know, public reaction to that snap 5-day lockdown than was the, the quite legendary tolerance and cooperation that people mostly displayed during the extended lockdown of 2020. Was that your sense, or is that just purely subjective?
Oh, I think that's absolutely right. I think there was slightly less compliance. But the thing that I noticed was that on Thursday, the bars and restaurants were absolutely overflowing down in St Kilda and Elwood with people who were just out celebrating the end of another lockdown.
Yes, I can imagine. And it came right in the middle of the Australian Open itself, a fairly controversial decision to go ahead with that tournament. We, you know, had the friction from the players at the start, and there was some community concern about whether it should have been happening. But in the end, it went ahead. It suffered that period of literally having no crowds, and you know, came to its conclusion last night. So there does seem to be, a sense of great relief that it's over. But it really just reinforces, Paul, doesn't it, that that we're vulnerable at the moment to these sorts of lockdowns happening again.
Yeah, I thought it was amazing that apparently all those people who had tickets to the finals were anti-vaxxers. I mean, all the booing and hissing that went on when the announcement that the vaccine was being rolled out was quite amazing this morning. It just
I was watching it last night, and I was somewhat puzzled by it. I'm still a bit puzzled by it. I'm not sure if you know what we're talking about here, Shirley, but when Jane Heidlicher, the CEO of Qantas, and I think she might be the chair of Tennis Australia, although I could be wrong on that, but anyway, she was giving an address, you know, at the awards ceremony at the end of the men's singles final, and when she talked about the vaccine rolling out, there was this quite strong booing and hissing that came from this crowd, and it made you think, are they upset? When I say I'm mystified by it, I wasn't entirely sure they were anti-vaxxers, but perhaps they were.
Yeah, I saw it, Mark, and one of the things that struck me, of course, was that Djokovic had been associated with some anti-vaccination comments in the past, and you wondered the extent to which the crowd who'd turned out to cheer him maybe were influenced by his comments.
Yeah, and doesn't that just show the how precarious this all is at the moment? I was noticing, for example, that in Britain, where the vaccination rollout has been, you know, being done at lightning speed because they've had to, you know, they've stuffed everything else up. And I think I heard this morning that 1 in 3 adult Britons has already been vaccinated, or at least had the first jab. And by July, they expect all adults in the UK to have been offered a vaccination. So they're moving quite quickly. And yet there's a growing sense in this country, we can talk about this a bit later in terms of the vaccination program, but there's a growing sense in this country that there are probably more people than we realised who are not interested in having the jab, who have concerns about it. And then, of course, there's the whole issue of whether we're going to be outrun, in a sense, by variants of the virus, given how slow it is. Now, it's worth talking about this because today the vaccinations are, you know, rolling out. As we record this, it's the first day of the administering of the Pfizer vaccine, the so-called 1A group. So, if that was an indication of where we are, that crowd noise last night, it is a bit of a worry.
Well, Nick Biddle here at ANU, the Centre for Social Research and Methods, published some work last week which suggested that 23% were either against it or in the wait and see category. Now, I don't know whether that's enough for herd immunity or whatever, but it certainly suggests that quite a sizable minority of the population are not going to be at the front of the queue getting the vaccine.
Well, Shirley, here's an interesting proposition. Scott Morrison's had the Pfizer jab now.
Yes.
Do you think he should have invited the leader of the opposition to do so at the same time? If this whole thing is about building community confidence, about sending the message that this is safe and effective, that it would have been best to make it as apolitical as possible, as bipartisan as possible, but also to reach as many people. Should he have invited Anthony Albanese as the opposition leader, and perhaps even the leader of the Greens, essentially, you know, all of the political leadership? And should they even now be trying to get some key community leaders? Because if particular ethnic or religious populations have deep concerns or deeper concerns about the vaccines, then it's going to affect the efficacy of the whole rollout.
Look, I absolutely would support that approach. I'm very concerned. There are some community groups here in Melbourne, for example, who are known to have an antipathy towards vaccinations in general. And it is very worrying that they may, in fact, opt out as a group from vaccination. It would be good to get as an inclusive group of leaders as they possibly can to front up on media and give their support to the vaccination program.
Yeah, I suppose with the way the government's done it, though, Paul, it's because they really, you know, I mean, whether they drag the chain or not, I don't know. There are different versions of this. The government says it was operating in an orderly manner and that it took a portfolio approach to securing different vaccines while they were in the development stage before it was known which ones would work better than others. But while there is this sense that the Pfizer vaccine is the best one and that the AstraZeneca and other vaccines aren't quite as good, there's always the risk that the political class looks like it's looking after itself if it's, you know, lining up for the Pfizer and telling everyone else, no, you're going to get a vaccine which, according to the medical trials, doesn't quite have the same level of efficacy.
Yeah, I think the optics of this were going to be a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation. Mm. Hunt said on Insiders yesterday, I think, that he had personally hand-delivered letters to Adam Bandt and Anthony Albanese inviting them to get it. I don't know whether that's next week or not, but I saw Gladys Berejiklian getting it this morning as well, and I think there's a danger if the public sees the politicians queuing up to have the jab that there'll be a sort of natural response to saying, well, you know, they're not frontline workers. How many of them do we need to convince the community that it's okay?
Yeah, it is. It's a bit of a balancing act, really, isn't it? Because there are strong concerns out there. I've read even of significant numbers of health workers, frontline health workers, who have doubts about it. In fact, I think I was reading in The Economist over the weekend about one doctor who said that a nurse he or she was dealing with had refused the vaccination, even though that same frontline healthcare worker had observed people in extreme trauma and stress and dying as a result of contracting the virus. It's pretty hard to imagine the kind of logic that gets you to that sort of conclusion, but there are doubts around, and so this idea of building confidence is obviously critically important, but I guess we're going to see how that plays out over time. I mean, I think, as I say, one of the real fears at the moment is that because of our orderly process, and this is something the government's made a great virtue of, because of our orderly process, we might have been ahead of the world in our response to the coronavirus. We've certainly done very well with very low levels of death, and now there's no community transmission right at the moment as we speak in Australia. But the rollout of the vaccine is actually quite some way behind a good many other countries. And the danger, of course, is that these variants will arise. They'll take hold in various places and potentially in Australia, either before we've got the current vaccine rolled out or the vaccine will turn out not to have any great effect on them.
Yeah, it's I'm not proposing to influence anyone, but I'm getting it.
Yeah, me too.
me too. And it'd be nice if they could actually think a little bit more about, you know, the groups that have been identified who have got serious doubts. And we're not talking about the extreme sort of anti-vax brigade. We're just talking about a lot of people who just are concerned about the safety because it's a new vaccine. If we could actually just identify the most influential people with those groups and make sure that they are publicly vaccinated and that they lend their support to the program.
Yeah, yes. I agree.
So this could be like cultural and religious minorities, for example, where there may be very strong belief systems and internal communication systems where, you know, doubts might be strong. There might be, you know, a consensus that it's not a good thing to do, or that it's unnecessary, or whatever. And they, look, it's probably the case that the authorities are right across this and are doing that kind of work. It's not the kind of work which I guess is going to be done by necessarily by public browbeating or shaming or whatever. It needs to be done by some pretty deft kind of domestic diplomacy, and as you say, Shirley, perhaps by getting some, you know, key community leaders and significant figures to make a virtue of it and show some leadership.
Yes, absolutely.
Let's go to this Facebook question. Having you know, obviously exercised our great expertise as epidemiologists as we just have. I mean, the country's full of them now. Why not us? But let's go to this question of Facebook, because that was really obviously a key decision by the company last week to suddenly turn off these news feeds on Facebook. The company clearly thinks that it has a right to do so and doesn't appear, surely, to want to be you know, brought to heel by a mere nation state, by a mere government. It feels that it's bigger than that, and that its product is should not be taxed, I suppose.
Yeah,
is that it?
Yeah, well, I think it's a very complicated issue, and I think that's why people are struggling to understand what's happening. But if you take a step back, the explosion of these digital platforms onto the scene have really left governments on the back foot, because the existing legal frameworks, regulatory frameworks, just can't deal with what we're experiencing. So, I think it's a bit like governments have been trying to control a herd of marauding elephants with traffic cones. And and not surprisingly, it ain't working.
Yeah, well, I mean, part of that, I guess, Paul, is because we've had this has sort of come about in historical terms quite quickly, this digital revolution, the emergence of these enormous platforms, Twitter and Facebook and Google and the like. These are absolute, as I said before, behemoths in a commercial sense. And they've come about really in a very short space of time. They have enormous reach all around the world. So you've got the speed of the change, which is itself a challenge for regulation, and they are by nature kind of supranational. They may be headquartered in the US or whatever, but their reach into these other, you know, all over the world, and their influence is, it defies, I mean, information sort of defies state borders, and the profit of these things defies any specific, so far, any specific regulation or proper taxation.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of really important issues in there. One is that, you know, a lot of the people who've been advocating for greater government control of media outlets and so forth have been for a generation preaching that the government shouldn't be controlling private enterprise, and so that to the extent that Facebook has taken a commercial decision, then that at one level is entirely in accord with the ideology that governments, Western governments, have almost invariably been advocating for the last 30 or 40 years. So now to say that the government needs to bring a multinational company to heel is in a sense a U-turn of quite considerable magnitude. I think there's also an historical issue, and that is that the rapid development of media technology at particular points in time is not new. And in fact, the governments, since at least the 17th century, at strategic moments, have attempted to silence media information provision, and mostly they've done that through the imposition of a tax.
Right, which becomes harder to do when you're dealing, because those manifestations you were talking about before, the creation of newspapers in particular, was a very localized thing. We used to have a lot more newspapers than we have now, right?
Yeah, sure.
They were everywhere. Australia, I think you've told me before that Australia had more newspapers than just about anywhere else per head of population.
Well, certainly within the British world, per capita, even though it was still officially a crown colony or convict colony, had more newspapers per capita than Britain itself. So the proliferation of the printing press was significant and very quickly beyond the control of government.
Let's take a quick break and be back in just a moment.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hi, I'm Sharon Bessel. Policy Forum Pod is the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. Each week, we bring together expert analysis to tackle the big issues facing our region and to propose policy solutions. It's insightful, it's positive, and it's always fun. Policy Forum Pod is out every Friday. You can find it on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Or find us at policyforum.net/podcasts.
Okay, welcome back. We were talking, Paul, just before the break about the proliferation of newspapers and you were kind of drawing out a historical precedent. We've had the rapid development of new media before in the case of newspapers, for example, and I was making the point that whilst that's true, the analogy sort of doesn't work in the sense, in the same sense that the thing about the internet is that it's global and these companies are international and they're certainly not headquartered here. They present all kinds of regulatory problems and their influence has been rapid and sort of bottom up. I mean, really. What we find, for example, is that around a third of Australians rely on Facebook's black magic algorithms to plate up their news these days. That is, they get whatever news they get from, you know, these news media companies, this third or so of the population is getting it delivered via Facebook. And via algorithms that decide what those people should get in their feeds. So that gives, that raises a whole lot of interesting issues, I suppose, in terms of the reach of the company and also the leverage that it feels that it now has. And that's what's driven it to this rather kind of dramatic decision to suddenly just turn it off rather than do what the government wanted to do, which was, and which the law is going to require, which is to make these companies that are going to run this, these news stories, make them reach commercial arrangements with the news companies that write them.
Well, again, there's, I think, a couple of really key issues there. One is that people don't have to get their news off Facebook. They can get their news off the source platforms. Mm-hmm. They can get their news off other platforms such as Google apparently is going to jump into this space in a big way. And so what Facebook are doing is restricting access rather than the provision of the news. And so I think that's an important point. Mm. It is also clearly algorithmic. I should point out the Australian Studies Facebook site has been shut down.
Yeah, one of countless because it's been deemed to be a news site, I guess, by the algorithm.
Yeah, well, I don't know. Surely how would that algorithm work? The number of times that the word news comes up?
Or? Look, I don't know. But, I mean, look, I think it's really interesting that we're all still talking about news provision when this is not a stoush about news. This is actually a stoush about money, about ad revenue and where those dollars flow. And again, if you take, you know, if we take a step back and look at 2017 when the Turnbull government abolished the cross-media ownership laws in Australia, they did so because they argued that traditional media needed this to survive the global internet giants like Facebook and Google. And what the, and it wasn't about news and news provision. It was actually about who could get ad dollars. And if you actually say, well, why would you do that? Because Australia already had one of the most highly concentrated traditional media ownership markets in the world. There's no ready answer to that. So what was the problem they were trying to solve? It was about dollars. It was never about, you know, ensuring that Australians received, you know, or protected the public interest or protected public interest journalism in Australia.
Yeah, I think I accept that point, but I think it sort of winds up in the same place anyway, does it not? Because these commercial news companies are basically saying that their business model is dying and that they are on the edge of viability because they're being gouged by these enormous platforms that are essentially stealing or monopolizing what ad revenue there is there without carrying the primary costs of actually creating this news content.
Yeah, and that is true. But is the problem that, you know, the payment of money, or is the problem the fact that you've actually allowed the growth of monopoly capitalism in this area in a way that has not been allowed to happen in other industries? Why are digital platforms special and different, and why should they be excluded from the kind of controls that governments have traditionally put in place over industries?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, it's gone down this path of wanting to have or requiring media companies to enter into good faith bargaining with these platforms, and that if those deals cannot be done over, I think it's a 90-day period or some sort of period like that, then an arbitrator can determine what the commercial value of that news content should be, and that money would then flow from Google and Facebook and others to News Corp and to Nine and Seven West Media and whoever else is entering into these deals. Now, Google's actually entered into deals now, I think, with all three of those companies. So it's interesting that one of the sort of data giants is there, but Facebook's playing hardball here, and maybe it's figuring that you know, like Paul said, I mean, people can get their news elsewhere. People will stay with Facebook. If they're not getting news on their Facebook feeds, then they're not getting news. They'll mostly either just not get news or go somewhere else.
Yeah, I think that's right. And Facebook are also arguing that they're fundamentally different from Google, because people don't really have much choice about whether or not their sites get caught up in the Google search.
Right.
Whereas people voluntarily, news organisations voluntarily put their pages up on Facebook.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And that's what Facebook argues that point. It says, hang on, so they post their material onto our platform and now they're telling us that we have to pay for it.
Is that because they understand, the news media companies, that this increases the circulation, increases their brand, and therefore their influence? So is the government and somehow, well, the government and us by at one remove, getting caught up in a war between media companies here? Is it about the public interest, or is it about a commercial stoush about who owns what?
It's a good question. I know Malcolm Turnbull, who's had a bit to say about this, takes the view that perhaps the government is taking the wrong approach, and that a simpler way to do it might be to just tax these companies more. I think he might be suggesting a specific tax that would apply to these large internet platforms, and then the revenue from that could be directed back to public interest journalism. What do you think of that idea, Shirley?
Well, I mean, there's a few things. One is that they are again coming from a starting point of accepting that these giant monopolies should continue to exist. And for example, why do you need this code which introduces sort of a mandatory arbitration if voluntary agreements can't be reached? It's because you know that the power imbalance is sitting on the side of, say, Google and Facebook. Why do you think you've got to bring in sort of like a super profits tax, if you like, for these platforms? Mm. Because they are monopolies. Well, what then is the marauding elephant? The marauding elephant is actually the monopoly position that these companies enjoy. And that is what they are all sort of sidestepping.
Well, it's interesting. Australia's leading the world here, as indeed we've had a bit of a tendency to do on some things, although not on others, I notice. It's been pointed out to me by someone just yesterday that we seem to take the view that we don't need to lead the world on climate change because that would be harming our best interests. But then on some other things, the government's quite assertive on leading the world, the coronavirus origin being one, and this being the other. That said, there are other countries around the world who are watching what Australia is doing very closely here. There's been positive support coming from within the UK government. I think Canada has indicated it wants to essentially go down the same path that Australia's going down. I think Europe, Paul, is also very keen to do something here to rebalance the situation against, as Shirley points out, against these giant monopolies. But my understanding is that the way they're looking at it is more of a kind of a copyright, stiffening the copyright rules, essentially saying if you didn't write it, you can't publish it, at least not without paying for it. So I don't know. Is Australia the sort of canary in the gold mine or voluntarily – the canary in the coal mine is probably not the right metaphor. It's more like we're one out at the moment. I'm wondering, does this need to be coordinated? There's some big meetings coming up this year, as we know. There's a G7 meeting in June. The Prime Minister's already made it clear that he expects to be discussing this at that meeting. So,
well, it just seems to me that, we had the minister in the Johnson government on saying how much they supported Australia, and they got the obvious question is, well, what are they going to do about it? And the guy started mumbling and guffawing and dissembling because I don't think they know what they're going to do about it. And Europeans, I think the idea of copyright law is, a trail of tears. I mean, the Europeans' cross-border copyright laws are a terrible mess. I mean, they can't even work out who owns the copyright when you buy a video. So how are they going to dig into this in any meaningful way? I don't know. And they're going to come up in spades against the almost untrammeled power of the media that outlets themselves to influence public opinion.
Shirley, do you think it needs to be a coordinated approach rather than, single countries like Australia taking it on, or is that the right way to go anyway?
Yeah, I think a coordinated approach would be an interesting one. But if you're actually looking at the trailblazers, I'd take a look at what they're doing in Texas, where they've filed a complaint alleging Google has monopoly power and forecloses competition in US markets. They've been accused of things like price fixing and tying arrangements, and they've also been accused of having an unlawful agreement with Facebook and to engage in deceptive trade practices. So to me, that's the case to watch.
Yes, that's an interesting one because that's a state within the United States taking on Google. It will be interesting to see where that goes and what sort of influence it has on US law. I guess the Biden administration will be interested in that as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
I still don't think we should underestimate the power of the internet platforms to fight back on this stuff. I mean, we all cheered when Trump got shut down from Twitter, et cetera, but who decides who gets shut down? And when do those voices within the community and within our democracy who should be in the public sphere start to get shut down? And I think there's a really dark potential here, ominous potential for you know, it's who is it that decides what who gets taken off Facebook or not?
Yeah, it's a very good question, and that I think has worried some people, the question of free speech. But these are private companies; these are private platforms. People participate in them voluntarily, and just like you know, you can't decide. You don't have a right to appear on the pages of The Australian or the Sydney Morning Herald. Those are private companies that decide that, and in a sense, that's no different from Google and Facebook and Twitter. Twitter perhaps is a slightly different example, but even Twitter, you can be, as we know, Donald Trump was removed from there as well. So, yeah, it's a really interesting one in a kind of a regulatory sense. Is support for this essentially, do you think, coming from, at least to the extent that it comes from the left, is it because it's well recognised that without a reliable news media and the prevalence of verified fact in our news feeds, that we head down the sort of path that Donald Trump was trying to take the US down, using those very social media devices to do it. I mean, he effectively fomented a huge upwelling of resentment over the American electoral system and incited that riot. And he did so basically using Twitter. So it's not just a financial issue here. There's the kind of stability of democracies themselves.
Yeah, look, I agree with you completely there, Mark. I think one of the ways in which Trump was so clever was that every time it looked like Facebook or Twitter or one of the other platforms was going to start controlling him or censoring him in some way, he would start talking about antitrust suits. He would start talking about attacking their monopoly status. And it was very interesting that he stayed on Twitter right up until the point when he was, he'd lost the presidency and then he was gone. So at the point in which they believed that he wasn't able in a position to follow through with those threats, he was gone. And that's why it's also interesting that this case against Google has arisen in Texas.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point, isn't it? I must say I hadn't thought of it in precisely those terms, that it was only after he was not in a position to retaliate in a legislative sense that they showed a bit of spine, given that he'd been using Twitter for the promulgation of fake news, just an absolute avalanche of lies since before even becoming president.
Well, and it also begs the question about, well, how bipartisan are these attempts by government to regulate the digital platforms going to be? Ultimately, is it like going to be like the, you know, you have to play with Murdoch before you get elected. Is it going to now that transfer into, you know, you have to play with Google, whoever Google is, in order to get elected? When is the bipartisanship about this going to break down?
Yeah, that's an interesting question as well, because you're dealing with these algorithms effectively. The way the algorithms are written can have such a strong material influence on communications, on if you're the opposition, for example, and you can't get a run, well, you're not getting a run for your messages. Perhaps that may be who do you complain to? Do you complain to Google? It says, oh, we're just a search engine. There's a lot of big questions here for democracy, and it seems like those questions aren't going to go away. Look, just before we go, just a couple of sort of final quick questions on this. Do either of you think that Facebook has overplayed its hand here, or I mean, do you think that it will back down, or is that just inconceivable?
Well, I think that's a very difficult question to answer. I think this has got a ways to run, and I think there are lots of conversations happening in the background.
What do you think, Paul?
Well, I just think it's going to end up being resolved in a way that looks like it's but every side's been happy.
They've saved Facebook.
They've saved Facebook. Yeah, well, you beat me to that one.
Sorry.
No, I was just going to say, again, in terms of the historical perspective that we've got here, governments in the 19th century chased printing presses relentlessly through stamp taxes and so forth, ended up giving up, didn't look like they'd compromised, ended up being the big users of the printing press in terms of political campaigning. And I can't help thinking that somehow we're going to end up in the same place this time.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because if you think about those early newspapers, they mostly begin as kind of radical anti-establishment type things, but their owners eventually become wealthy insiders and supporters of the establishment, pretenders to it. And there's a very strong, you know, that's a very strong theme running right through the development of mastheads in Australia, the ones that survived. You know, they go from left to right. And you can sort of see that typical trajectory. Mm. It'd be interesting to see whether we have a similar process here. I mean, the difference, one of the differences is these data giants, they proclaim the idea that they are really the sum total of all of their users. You know, that's one of their key defenses, isn't it? You can't do me for defamation because it's not me who's saying it. I'm just the platform. I'm just the rails on which this train is running or whatever it is.
Yeah, and I think one of the other things to remember is that this whole fight has been done in the name of public interest journalism. And I think it's worth watching carefully that even once revenue does start to flow, for example, from Google to the various news organisations, whether that actually results in a net increase in public interest journalism. And you really only have to look at the fate, for example, of the ABC over the last couple of years to really seriously question what the commitment to public interest journalism is here.
That's a good point too, isn't it, Paul? Because these other companies, leaving aside the ABC for a moment, they are private companies also. So it's not like, I mean, if you can see the revenue directed there, this transfer from the big data platforms to those media companies, but the state, the government has no dog in that fight in terms of whether they spend that money on hiring more journalists and doing, you know, putting more resources into investigative journalism and the like.
No, absolutely. They end up paying huge bonuses to the people who run the companies.
I mean, precisely. We've seen that with JobKeeper, really. I mean, you know, public money going straight from the government into these companies, paying bonuses and share dividends.
And at some point, they'll all sign up to a feel-good code of conduct that's full of platitudes, and you know it'll just be game on as usual. I think in this sense, the only hope that I think that we have still is that that we have an independent ABC that's out there saying, giving a more balanced perspective on these issues,
and a few podcasts.
even though we might get taken down.
Yeah, that's right. Well, look, thanks very much, Paul Pickering and Shirley Leach, for your thoughts. It's been really terrific having you back on Democracy Sausage, and we'll look forward to doing so again very soon.
It's been a pleasure.
Pleasure as always.
And that's Democracy Sausage for this episode. See you next time.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.